in general, the Irish electricity industry was in a very backward state at the time of independence. First of all, it was very fragmented. Every town had its own little generating station, usually attached to a business, and very often just there to serve the shop or the mill or whatever it happened to be. In the big cities, the supply was very confined. Less than 15% of the population had electricity. The local authorities very often controlled it in the bigger areas, and they were competing against each other. So you had a variety of systems, of different types of system and so forth, in use over a very small area. So there was no possibility of any sort of cooperation. In addition, the idea of electricity as a public service hadn't really come into existence at that stage, or the idea that electricity could prove a major force to industrialise the whole country hadn't really been thought about. And this was partly why the idea of a national scheme which would help to electrify the whole country and serve as the basis for industrialisation was seized upon by the Free State government, because they realised they had to do at least two things. One was they had to show the outside world that they were capable of governing and capable of doing something which would demonstrate this, and the Shannon scheme could be visible proof both at home and abroad of this, which it was. The second thing was they realised they had to move Ireland away from being a predominantly agricultural country. They had to give it some sort of industrial basis, and again they saw the Shannon scheme and the ESB as the means of doing this.
Maurice Manning, recalling the thinking that led to the setting up of the ESB. In the 1920s, the use of electricity wasn't widespread. W.F. Rowe, who worked for Dublin Corporation Electricity Department at the time, recalls what the situation was like.
Well, there were private companies all over the country. And surprisingly enough, some of the big towns hadn't any. Places like Athlone and Kilkenny had no supply companies, while some of the smaller places had, like Clonakilty and so on.
And in Dublin?
In Dublin, there were three companies in the Dublin conurbation. There was Dublin City, Rathmines and Pembroke, and there was also a supply system in Dunleary.
There was opposition to the setting up of a unified authority, opposition to the ESB, and even before that, opposition to the Shannon scheme.
The opposition to Siemens getting the contract came from, I suppose, the ex-unionist element in Ireland at the time. The country was only 2 or 3, 4 years independent at this stage. And it came, first of all, from the Irish Times. The Irish Times was opposed, number one, to a scheme as big as this. It thought that it would probably end up in national bankruptcy, and thought the government... I think it felt instinctively that this new government didn't really have the expertise or the skill or the character to carry it all through. So they were opposed to it. They also feared the German influence. And, of course, the Great War wasn't 10 years over at this stage. The Irish Times had been very anti-German during the war, and it didn't like the idea of giving this large contract to a German firm, and it talked about the Teutonising of the Free State, which would follow from the importation of large numbers of engineers and technicians and so on. As well, opposition came from the Morning Post, the arch conservative paper in London, which regarded the giving of the contract to Siemens as almost an unfriendly act by the Free State government. Opposition came as well from the financial community in Ireland, from many of the bankers and big business people, for two reasons. They saw it, number one, as state socialism, and they were opposed to the state intervening in any way in what they regarded as business. They were also afraid of the cost of the whole thing, and I think lacked confidence in the ability of the government to carry it through. And, of course, opposition came from all of the existing, as they were called, undertakers, those who owned private electricity generating stations, and who were strongly who were afraid of what would happen. And these people were organised mainly in the Dublin Chamber of Commerce, and the Chamber of Commerce fought a long battle with McGilligan. A number of meetings were, in fact, broken up. McGilligan gave better than he got. He could be very tough, almost abusive on occasion, when he doubted the motives of those whom he was fighting. And, in fact, in the end, he had to fight two campaigns against them, the campaign over the building of the Shannon scheme and the campaign over the setting up of the ESB. In each case, he used very rough methods, and in each case, he won.
Despite all the opposition, the ESB got started. Dr. P.G. Murphy was there at the very beginning.
Yes, I was the first employee. In 1925, the government decided to build the Shannon scheme. That's the hydroelectric development of the Shannon River at Limerick or Ardnacrusher. And 2 years later, McGilligan decided that he'd have to set up a board to run the Shannon scheme and all connected with it. And he passed the Electricity Supply Act, which set up the ESB. Now, in recruiting the staff, they looked for people with experience, and I was happened to be lucky and one of the few that had experience in high tension. And I got the job. That's where I began.
Two names keep cropping up in the history of the early days of the ESB. One is that of Patrick McGilligan, a tough Minister of State. The other, Dr. Tommy McLaughlin, who is now talked of as virtually the only progenitor of the ESB. P.J. Dowling worked closely with him.
He was a man who was very full of energy and full of life and a very alert mind. And his enthusiasm for electrical development really was the dominant thing in his life. He, anybody that went against that, as far as he was concerned, they were wrong. And he would then proceed to find out were there ulterior motives prompting them, or were they genuine in their objections, or whatever it might be. And he consequently made several enemies, even from ministers and civil servants and business interests, even down to his own colleagues in the board. But most of them would admit, I think, that they had to pay a fair amount of respect to his point of view, even though ultimately they mightn't agree with it. Before the ESB was set up, as you know, there were very many, possibly a couple of hundred different undertakings in the country. And the ESB had to come along then, develop the Shannon to produce the electricity. But then they had the very big and daunting job of trying to sell the electricity produced from the Shannon, which, as you know, at the time was called White Elephant and several other unbecoming names.
Of course, the early 30s were the years of the Depression.
Oh, yes. But even before the acute Depression, there was considerable opposition to the Shannon scheme. You see, there were rival schemes on the mat. The Liffey scheme, promoted by some Dublin interests. And the struggle went on there. But the main... Dr. McLaughlin, I think, deserves to be remembered for two things. First of all, the development of the Shannon, which really was his baby. Secondly, the problem of how to dispose of the electricity. The original intention was develop the Shannon, produce the electricity, sell it to all the existing supply authorities around the country. That would be Dublin, Rathmines Urban Council, Pembroke Urban Council, Dunleary Borough, Cork, Limerick and so on, and all the other towns that had supply. Now, the really important decision was that that would not allow development to take place rapidly enough. And the boards decided very early on that they should acquire all these undertakings and build a network around the whole country and supply all the towns under a unified scheme and unified rates of charge.
And you'd say this was Dr. McLaughlin's...
He was absolutely sold on that. And anyone that opposes, they had a very tough fight on their hands.
The board of the ESB had been set up, and the first 2 or 3 years really were concerned with getting Ardnacrusher into the national system and with extending the scheme to as many parts of the country as possible, starting off in Leinster. This meant that work went ahead at a very frenetic pace. But McLaughlin, who was a great goer, who had tremendous enthusiasm, who wanted to get things done, didn't pay very much attention to the actual details of accounting. And within a very short space, the accounts of the board were in an appalling mess, and there were no proper records kept of many things. There was no question of any dishonesty or any fiddling of any kind, but there was a mess. Well, that was the first point. The second point was that McGilligan, as minister, was perhaps almost overprotective of the scheme, and his whole reputation was bound up in it. But he felt that he and the government weren't getting sufficient information from the board as to what was happening. So an almighty row blew up in late 1929, early 1930, between the government, McGilligan, and the board, especially McLaughlin. This row resulted in the sacking from the board of the chairman, John Murphy, who had been town clerk of Dublin. He resigned from the board, and so did McLaughlin. He resigned, in fact, on the instructions of the government. This was a huge rift between McGilligan and McLaughlin, who had been very close friends before that, and in fact who had caused the scheme to come into existence. Probably in the end they were both wrong. McLaughlin was wrong in that he wasn't paying enough attention to accounting procedures. He wasn't answering to the government. He was too much in a hurry. McGilligan was probably wrong in that he was a little bit too legalistic about the whole thing and didn't make allowances for teething troubles. At least afterwards, I think they both would agree that they had both been a little wrong. Anyway, McLaughlin came back a year later because Fianna Fáil came to power in 1932, and one of their first acts was to appoint McLaughlin back to the board of the ESB.
In those early days, the ESB was not the streamlined giant we know today. Bill Rowe and Dr. Murphy, both of whom were to rise to high office, remember humble beginnings.
I was the first junior Irish engineer to report to the board, and I always remember I arrived at 9:30 in the morning, full of enthusiasm, and went into the building in 30 Merrion Square, and I couldn't find anybody. I went through all the rooms. Every room was the same, with battleship lino, table and chair, and what was known as a civic guard press. And I sat on the stairs until 11:30 when the first of the board that arrived.
When I got the job, first job with the ESB, I was the first, or one of the first two, that was appointed an engineer. The ESB's headquarters then was one flat in a house, I can't remember the number, but it was opposite the hall door of the present government buildings. And I arrived the first day and I said, well, now what am I to do? They said, your first job is to go out and buy a chair for the secretary. You'll be appointed tomorrow.
In those early years, growth was steady, if slow. Inevitably, there were problems, most of them growing pains.
I was sent out to Bray in 1928, and we erected a new overhead network there and put in a 10,000-volt underground distribution system to feed that network. Every house in Bray was then connected to the new network. It was necessary to change all the appliances that the people had because they were DC 110-volt. And that was our first experience of changing over a town. After that, indeed, we changed over many towns. Later, when I was district engineer in Port Leisha, I remember at one time we changed over 7 towns at the one time. I remember I was running out of staff to such an extent that when we were changing over Moat in County Westmeath, the man in charge was 16 years of age, an apprentice. That was the best we could do.
Once the Shannon was harnessed, other rivers came in for consideration.
The Shannon was very successful economically, and from that the board decided to develop other rivers. So they surveyed all the major rivers in Ireland, and they developed eventually the River Erne, the River Lee, and the River Liffey. Hydropower was the cheapest at that time because with hydro you spend a lot of capital, but the running costs are very slight. Whereas if you're using a fuel, the price varies with the fuel, and you can see from the day's price of oil the advantage of water power.
In the late 30s came World War II, and the advantages of water power then became obvious. But the Pigeon House ran on coal. Charlie Kenny was working there, as indeed he had worked during World War I. The fuel situation during the First World War had been good.
Well, the fuel at that time was good. It was Scotch nuts, steam coal. It was easy to work. The coal practically worked itself because we had conveyors which took the coal right up into the bunkers. And there was levers along the line for dumping into different bunkers, guarding whatever bunker you wanted to dump into.
That was in 1917. But during the Second War, there were no Scotch nuts.
Well, when the Second World War came, it wasn't long on until we started getting this very, very bad cold, slurry. It has various names.
I could imagine.
And I needn't tell you, we called it various names too. But it was really a terrible trial. And the only thing about it was it did employ men. In fact, there was three men implied where there should be only one, or even more. I could put it at a higher rate. I'd say there were even four men where there should be only one. And instead of the machinery conveying the coal, the men were actually trying to shove the coal along on the machines. It was a heartbreaking job.
Dublin City depended on the Pigeon House, and somehow the demands were met.
The station, as far as I can recollect, it was fuelled on rubbish, more or less, anything they could get. And as a matter of fact, it is a well-known fact that during the war, when the load would get a bit heavy, particularly in the evening time, there was men, a couple of men used to go around and put out the street lights in order to keep the load a bit lighter.
The chief executive of the ESB, James Kelly, qualified as an engineer during the war. He remembers the Pigeon House.
I came to the ESB as a young graduate engineer just after the war, actually. And my first assignment was in the old Pigeon House station. I can remember coming out of college with a lot of textbook knowledge, but going down to a very challenging situation. I don't think people really realised the part Pigeon House was playing in electricity supply in those days. We had only two main power stations, which were dependent on the one hand on rainfall and on the other on very inferior type coal. I can remember the sight of coal boats coming into Pigeon House with grass growing on the top of them, and I wondered about this, and then I found that it was really scrapings off the top of some of the slag heaps in Britain. I can remember also the quality of the coal. It was very sticky stuff. Part of my job was doing very sophisticated tests in the laboratory and making announcements as to whether it would burn or wouldn't burn, whereas the men on the floor, I remember, had very unsophisticated ways. They just took a fistful of it and threw it against the wall, and if it stuck to the wall, they told you it wouldn't burn, and they were usually right.
When peace came in 1945, it was a new beginning for the ESB. There was very little production at that time.
We tend to forget that now. We only had two stations. We had Ardna Croitia and we had Pigeon House. We now have 28 power stations and altogether a more complex system. But we moved on from these very difficult years in the late 40s and early 50s. The next thing on the horizon was the government decision to develop turf on a large scale in the country, and the ESB then had the challenging job of burning it. There was some technology available in Germany on sod peat, but when a new form of peat production came along, that's milled peat, we didn't have the technology in Western Europe, and we had the challenge of developing that technology.
Moore McDowell, who with Maurice Manning is writing a history of the ESB, has reservations about the commitment to turf. He feels it was uneconomic.
No, it was entirely uneconomic. The ESB was railroaded into using turf, which it didn't want to use in the early 1930s. It was railroaded into it simply in order to make the Turf Development Board, as it was then, later Board Namona, to make its programme viable. It never made any economic sense to the ESB. In fact, they fought hard against it, but they were completely outmanoeuvred by a combination of Andrews, who is a very powerful personality, as you probably know, and Lammas. Andrews very close to Lammas, and it's fairly clear that they railroaded the ESB into using this and using turf, for the thermal station simply wouldn't hear of anything other than turf. Lammas called them in and read the Riot Act and said he was building a wall around the country, and that if he heard any more nonsense about using imported coal or imported oil, there'd be, and a quote I remember from a memorandum, there'd be hell to pay. So Brown, the chairman of the board, really had no option but to give in on it. And that was the that's how the ESB got involved in turf. It certainly of course, wasn't their own choice.
Looking at it dispassionately, it was making use of the only natural resource we had in the way of energy, apart from water.
Yeah, it was. The ESB would argue, and I'd be inclined to agree with them, that if the government wants turf used, if for social reasons, the balance of payments, employment, then it's up to them to say, right, if turf is uneconomical, we will explicitly pay the ESB a subsidy to use turf. Instead of which, what they said to the ESB is, you will use such turf as Bordna Muna may provide at such a price as Bordna Muna may charge. And of course, Bordna Muna simply charged the price to clear its own problems, and then the extra costs passed on to the consumer. So it's a disguised subsidy, and the ESB was put in the position of not being able to control either the price of its fuel or indeed the quantity of it, because if there was a bad year, well, that was just tough. There was no turf available, or, well, there was never no turf, but supplies wouldn't come up to the required amount.
Water and turf were the native sources of power. Oil-fired stations were built, but there was always the knowledge that control of this source was not in our hands. Dr. P.G. Murphy recalls the search for marginal sources of power.
We experimented with wind power. We built a small wind power station and we discovered what most of the big countries before us had discovered, that it was a very expensive method of generating electricity and it was very unreliable because one good storm will blow any mast down.
The decision to bring electricity to the country at large was a courageous one. Rural electrification was fraught with difficulties. W.F. Rowe.
You will realise that in 1945, particularly January 1945, the war was still at its height and it was impossible to get material of any kind. So we laid our plans and set up our organisation, started training men, recruiting men. And we've got very few men from the existing ESB staff because it had been run down during the war when, of course, there was a slump in line building and everything else. We realised that we had to erect 1 million poles or more. We started off by breaking the country up into areas. We based the area on a parish, roughly about 25 square miles. Now, the parishes varied tremendously in size, but we made the big ones small and the small ones big, so that we usually got about 25 square miles.
Nearly every parish in Ireland set up its organising committee. Radio Éireann eavesdropped on such a committee in Banshire, where Father Hayes was the chairman.
Well, now we have come to a very important item of the programme tonight. I'm sure you're all very interested in it. It is the question of rural electrification. For the parish. That means getting electricity into every house in the parish. The one thing I'm worried about, you know, will the people take it? I have no doubts. That'll be most useful. But what do you think? Will they take it now?
Well, I believe they will take it, Reverend Chairman, when it's explained to them the facilities, the usefulness and all the rest of it, of having the electric light installed. I have no doubts that they'll take it.
Mm-hmm. But how will you go about it, Emma? How will we go about it now?
Well, I propose, Father, here, to get the parish council together and let him canvass all the people of the parish and see if I know how many of them is interested in it. Until we have enough them to see if they're all interested and go ahead with it.
No, I'll call to every house, would you like?
Make a canvass to every house, Father, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But before we go canvassing, wouldn't we want to have an idea of the cost to be able to let the householders know?
That's an important point, isn't it?
To know according to the area of their house.
I know.
Houses, what they'd have to pay per month or 2 months, as the case may be.
So you'd be able to tell them exactly in or about what the cost is?
Yes.
They'd be nervous otherwise.
Reverend Chairman.
Yes, Tom.
I wonder what would the cottage cost? Light for the week.
Well, no, somebody told me where they have done it at about 1 eighth a week for a cottage. And you know, the important thing is that the county council will put the light free for you. But your 1 eighth a week would be only 7 candles, isn't that all?
I'd like to say that.
Would you? You're preferred to the candles.
Well, Reverend Chairman, is it light only we'll get in? On the farm?
Oh, I know. You mean, could you use it for a walk on the farm?
Yes.
Well, I think, mind you, that all the light's important to the least part of it. It is a walk on the farm for
It'll be more important if you when you be getting in then, to have the...
To use it for the farm work.
The farm work.
And what about the missus and an iron?
Oh, it'll be very useful for her, all right.
You forget that sometimes, the farmer's wife.
I think that it is necessary to have a general meeting summoned and have the views of the people on this. And I propose that we have a Sunday morning announcement for a general meeting.
Well, are you in favour of that now?
Yes.
All right, so. And then you'll help to canvass the whole area, then?
We'll all do our own area, our own fair.
A lot of different areas.
Well, help the guard to brighten up the parish anyway.
Yes.
The ESB sent their men through the length and breadth of Ireland to brighten up the parishes. Their instructions were to complete one scheme in each of the 26 counties before starting on a second project in any one county.
When we arrived in a village, we first of all got in touch with our local committee. Now, the local committee was usually headed by the curate, the creamery manager or the teacher. And with their help, we had to get digs for our various staff. And then we had to recruit casual labour to do the donkey work. Now, perhaps donkey work is a bad word. I'll say to do the heavy digging and hauling. Each area had a crew of about 80 men, and it took 4 months, roughly, to complete an area, each area costing about £80,000. In the whole country, there are something like 800 areas.
When our men were going around canvassing for consumers, the standard radio set was the ordinary wet battery radio. You had to bring the battery to the garage every week to be charged, and the cost was something like, say, 2 shillings, I forget the amount. But adding that up, you found that the cost of charging the battery would be nearly about what these small houses would have to pay as their fixed charge for electricity. And this was one of the biggest selling points in getting the smaller houses to sign up for supply. Some of these houses were very small and very poor, of course. I remember seeing in North Mayo, north of Killala, what must be one of the smallest electrical installations in the world. The two wires from the ESB pole came into the kitchen door, and just inside the kitchen door there was the meter. There was about 2 feet of wire from the meter up to a light and a switch beside the light, and that was the complete installation. Now, people may be inclined to scoff at that as an electrical installation, but that light was in their kitchen, in their living room, and the difference that light, 100 watt lamp, made to living in that house, I didn't ask you.
But did they use 100 watt bulbs? I believe they were very averse to using anything that burned power.
Well, we had a very interesting scheme in the rural areas. We gave a free 100 watt lamp to every rural consumer that was connected, on the theory, on the basis that if they got used to a good light in a room, they wouldn't put in a smaller lamp when it burned out. And that scheme, I think, was very successful.
You did this, if you'll excuse the pun, in the light of previous experience that they were using very low-powered bulbs indeed.
Well, some of them were, I admit. But I think our scheme worked very well.
What kind of effect had it? Apart from anything else, it must have shown up houses that they hadn't actually seen before.
Oh, there was a tremendous improvement in the overall appearance of the houses. People began to see that they wanted walls, wanted decorating and this type of thing. And they certainly rose to the occasion. It was just they didn't realise it before. It wasn't that they were lazy or slovenly or anything else. It's just they didn't realise the things wanted doing. And then, of course, the change in rural life with electricity. I mean, it would take a whole programme to go into all the advantages, or if you like, all the disadvantages of living without electricity, starting with running water, See, in the rural areas, they weren't able to turn up tap like you can in a town and get water. They were maybe a quarter of a mile away or half a mile away in many cases from another house. They had to depend on their own water supply. And very often they might have a pump in the yard or they had to go to a river for water. But very often it was a very tedious job. With electricity, kind of these small automatic pumps. And that certainly revolutionised living in the country.
The erection of the vast network of poles and line is still remembered vividly by the men who accomplished it. Men like Ricky Nally, Bobby Byrne, James Douglas and Bill Rowe.
The first pole wasn't erected until November 47 because there was tremendous difficulty in getting material. We found that the cheapest way to buy our poles was to import them directly from Finland ourselves. We sent a man to Finland who made an initial purchase of 90,000 poles. And the 90,000 poles that were delivered, first of all, they had to be seasoned. And then creosoted, having been stripped first. Then we had to distribute them around the country to the various areas. For this, we had to purchase a fleet of articulated vehicles.
I was doing some surveying for a 10,000-volt line between Tala and De Selby quarries, and I was chased from a field by a bull. And I certainly didn't like it because I had a heavy waterproof coat on. I was carrying a theodolite, and I just made it to the gate and got outside. But the following morning going out, I was telling one of our, if you like, well-experienced and senior linesmen about this, and he said, well, look, I'll go out there with you, and I'm sure we'll be able to manage that bull all right. So he came out in any case, and we duly went to the field and opened the gate. He went in. The bull came running across to investigate what was going on. My friend got behind the bull, caught him by the tail, and ran him round and round that field until he lay down exhausted.
Of course, in the early days, the equipment wasn't anything like the latter-day equipment. And it was mostly all manual work, with the exception of the continuous use of explosives. But they even produced their problems because you run into ground that was too soft to use explosives in. Bad weather makes the work very, very difficult because it softens up the ground. You're flooded with water. You're accursed by trying to keep pumps going. And you have to case the holes because the weather, the ground is inclined to tumble in at 8 and 9 foot depths, huge holes.
There was this church. It was the time of the rural electrification, and I was on this job with two electricians. I was still the apprentice, and we were wiring this church for light and heat, and the church must have had what must have been the first all-electric confession box in this country, because the parish priest wanted to have a light to read by when clients were slack, and a foot warmer for the cold weather, and a buzzer that could be rung by his housekeeper from the house to acquaint him of the fact that his ministrations were urgently required in another part of the parish.
I remember talking to a blacksmith in County Carlow, and he had electricity in his forge. Now, he had a small farm as well as the forge. He brought me into the forge, and he was quite a progressive little man. He had drills and saws and a thing blowing the fire, all worked electrically in the forge, and he was very pleased with them. And I was admiring this and said, that's very good. Well, he said, now come and I'll show you the best thing I have. And he brought me out and he showed me the light he had in his farmyard. And I said, why is that the best thing you have? See, I can do my work in the forge now until I'm finished. And then I can, even though it's dark, I can go out and finish my yard work as well. Whereas before, he said, I used to have to get all the farm work done before it was dark.
The French say that appetite comes in eating. The appetite for electricity seems to be insatiable, and the problem is to decide what fuel will meet that appetite most economically.
Towards the end of the 60s,
we began to get very worried about the increased dependence we had on imported oil. We saw that all of that oil was coming from the Middle East, a rather politically unstable source, and we began making our plans for diversifying away from it. The government made the decision that the ESB should get on with planning a nuclear station. We were proved right by the events of the Arab action in 1973. We have developed plans for a nuclear station and we're keeping them right up to date in accordance with the government decision. But a number of things have happened meantime to slow down the urgency of a nuclear station. First of all, the recession itself meant that we haven't had growth for 3 or 4 years. The government made us an allocation of the gas find off Kinsale. And because of the price of oil, some of the more outlying areas of turf are now economic, and Bournemouth are getting on with the job of producing turf from them. So the urgency for a nuclear station really receded because of these events.
A significant recent development was the opening of the pump storage scheme at Thurlock Hill.
It's not a new scheme, there are other ones in the world, but it is a totally new technology for Ireland. You know, one of the problems we have about electricity is that you can't store it, but Thurlock Hill provides a form of storage in that plant that would otherwise be shut down at night time when load is very light. We use it instead for pumping water up to an upper lake, artificial lake, which we constructed. And then during the daytime, when we need electricity, when industry comes on and increased cooking and lighting and so on, we use it. We use the water there to generate electricity on its way down.
Is that economic? It does not cost you more to pump the water up than the value you get out of it coming down again?
No, because we're using our most efficient plant, which would otherwise be shut down. We get 3 units of electricity out for every 4 we use in pumping.
What does the future hold? I asked Moore McDowell.
Very difficult. I wouldn't like to be in the chief executive's shoes. It's a very, very difficult business planning for the future in the ESB. When you think that if you want a power station, let's suppose you're going to go nuclear and you're going to build a power station which is going to come on stream. You plan today for a station which is going to come on stream anything up to 10 years from now. So you're not only attempting to forecast the demand for electricity 10 years ahead, but you're locking the system into a method of generating electricity based on your hunch as to how relative prices of coal, oil, and so on are going to behave. At the moment, they have problems. They don't know what oil is going to be available. Will there be more strikes of natural gas? Will coal prices rise relative to oil or oil relative to coal? Will nuclear power be acceptable politically? You know, there's all this problem about in Sweden and the United States. And all these things make it extremely difficult for the ESB to forecast. We know that there's going to be a growth in the demand for electricity, and they're going to have to meet it. And they would, I suppose most people in the ESB would say, well, we'll operate on the basis of 10% per annum being the what we're likely to experience over the next 15, 20, 25 years to the end of the century. But the problems that they face in planning the capacity to meet that and to meet it optimally in the sense of at the minimum cost are really appalling. If you think of it, it's sort of Russian roulette, except instead of having only one bullet in the 6 chambers, there are about 5 of them. Your chances of getting the right answer are a bit remote.
What has the ESB achieved in its first 50 years?
I heard Gunnar Rugheimer say one time that if you drew a line around Dublin that roughly corresponded to the old Pale, that the rest of the country was in attitude at least 100 years behind what was inside the Pale. But with electricity and television, this is no longer true. That I suppose you could say electricity seduced Ireland into the 20th century.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.